Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for today. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's special guests, Michael Duffy and Nancy Gibbs. Nancy Gibbs is the deputy managing editor of Time Magazine and has held previous positions of senior editor, chief political writer, and editor-at-large, all at Time Magazine. She is the co-author, along with today's other guest, Michael Duffy, of the New York Times bestseller, The Preacher and the Presidents, Billy Graham in the White House. Nancy was named by the Chicago Tribune as one of the 10 best magazine writers in the country, and she is the author of more than 150 Time Magazine cover stories and now writes the back essay page as well. Her story for the black-bordered special issue on September 11, 2001, won the National Magazine Award, and she was the lead writer for Time Magazine on virtually every major news event from the Oklahoma bombing to Hurricane Katrina, as well as the last five presidential campaigns. Nancy has also focused on stories exploring the intersections of religion, values, and politics. Nancy Gibbs graduated summa cum laude from Yale University with honors in history, and she also has a degree in politics and philosophy from Oxford University, where she was a Marshall Scholar. She has twice served as the Ferris Professor at Princeton, where she taught a seminar on politics and the press. Nancy is a frequent guest on the Today Show, Good Morning America, the CBS Evening News and the Charlie Rose Show, and PBS's The NewsHour. She currently resides in Westchester, New York, with her husband and two children. Michael Duffy was named Assistant Managing Editor of Time in 2005 and currently is the magazine's executive editor. Michael directs the coverage of presidents, politics, and national affairs for both Time Magazine and Time.com. He joined Time in 1985 as a Pentagon correspondent, covering Congress, the White House, and national security. Michael Duffy has written over 50 cover stories for Time and has won the Gerald R. Ford Award for his reporting on the presidency and on defense and national security issues. He has covered the administrations of Presidents H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, as well as many other presidents. And in 1997, Michael devoted a large amount of his time on campaign finance scandals. He was a part of a team that won the 1998 Goldsmith Award for investigative reporting from the Joan Shorenstein Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Michael Duffy has also been a Ferris Professor of Journalism at Princeton University, and for the past 15 years, he has appeared regularly on PBS's Washington Week in Review. Michael Duffy was born in Columbus, Ohio, graduated from Oberlin College, and currently lives with his wife and three sons in Maryland. So please welcome Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy from Time Magazine to the Commonwealth Club of California and listen to them discuss their new book, The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity.
Thank you, Joe. I am tempted to go right to questions. we're here today to talk about a book that has taken us in places we didn't expect to go as journalists and amateur historians. We all love to read biographies, particularly political biographies. I think probably a lot of people here would like to read biographies of presidents. Some of my favorite books are Edmund Morris on Teddy Roosevelt and David McCulloch on Harry Truman. I see nodding heads. Anything by Robert Caro, including the new one, volume 14. But I've lost track exactly which volume it is, but I'm going to read the whole thing as soon as I can get my hands lifted. Yeah. These are my favorite things to read, and if I can block out a week to read them, I usually try to, because I just love getting lost in them. And we tend to think of presidents that way, one at a time. We hold them up and just look at them both when we're at Time, but also as when we're just casual readers of books and biographies. And it's fun to do, which is why probably Nancy and I tried to do something no one's ever done before, which is to look at them in pairs or in groups of three and find out whether, you know, we think as we've gotten older that relationships matter a great deal. And how people manage relationships matters a great deal, whether you're in public service or you're in business or you're in whatever you do. And so as reporters and editors, we tried to do something different with this book, which was to hold these men up against each other and see what sparks may fly, how they treated each other. And we thought we'd learn a couple of things. We thought we'd learn something about themselves, the individuals who we have chosen to be commanders-in-chief. We thought we'd learn something about the presidency, the office of the presidency, which is, you know, even after 30 years of this, I have to say, is the most important job that we do have in government. And I think we thought, going into this, that we might learn something about us, why our country is working or not working, our politics are working or not working, if we examined these relationships closely and not as individuals. And so, rather informally, we came up with the idea of what we called the club, looking at all the presidents from essentially Truman on, although we have Herbert Hoover to start us off, and to see what these relationships, this group of men, told us about all the things that we wanted to understand better. So every club has its creation myth, and so we'll start with, I'm going to skip that picture and go on to the next one, how this club started.
So what you're seeing in this picture is one of the most remarkable meetings of presidents in the 20th century. Harry Truman and Herbert Hoover, two of the most unlikely imaginable friends or allies, politically as different as can be, personally very different, two men who had no history together. But this meeting took place just a few weeks after Truman finds himself suddenly president in the spring of 1945. The war in Europe is coming to an end. And he is facing so much trouble on so many fronts. And one of the things that is worrying him most is the fact that Europe has been so devastated by the war that literally millions and millions of people are at risk of starvation. Agriculture has been destroyed, transportation has been destroyed. Even countries that have any food, there's no way to get it to the countries that don't. And so Truman realizes that there is one guy who actually has the experience and the skill set to help solve what is essentially a massive engineering problem, and that is a president who had been an engineer, and that's Herbert Hoover. And not only did Hoover have a gift for solving very complicated puzzles, this is a guy who liked to take apart clocks in his spare time and put them back together again. He had served as Woodrow Wilson's sort of food czar during World War I. He knew how to do this. And everyone in Washington knew Hoover knew how to do this, but every time they'd suggested to Franklin Roosevelt that maybe you should call in Hoover to help with the civilian catastrophe that's looming in Europe, Roosevelt would say, "I am not Jesus Christ. I am not raising Herbert Hoover from the dead." Truman did not feel this way. Truman felt, "So this is a guy who can solve an enormous problem. I need his help." So he secretly mails a letter to Hoover asking if he would come in and meet with him, because he knows everyone else in the White House would be mortified at this idea. And hence you have this picture of the two men meeting. They're very suspicious of each other. Hoover doesn't think anything is going to come of this, much as he wanted to help. He didn't think there's any way that a Democratic president is actually going to enlist a pariah Republican president in a mission this important. Well, within the next year, Truman had handed Hoover a plane and a staff and all the help and support he could need, sent him 50,000 miles around the world to 22 countries to meet with 36 prime ministers and 7 kings and the Pope in the course of engineering the massive global transfer of food from countries that had it to countries that needed it. And in so doing, managed to forestall what could have been one of the worst civilian catastrophes of the 20th century. And so it is that on Inauguration Day, 8 years later, as Dwight Eisenhower is getting ready to take office, Hoover greets Truman on the platform and says, "Mr. President, I think we should form a president's club." And Truman says, "Great, you be the president, I'll be the secretary." And so in a sense, that's how it's born, except they're not the only ones who think of themselves as a club, who realize now that they've got something between them that's rather unusual and special. As Truman said, he said, "You know, yeah, Hoover, he's to the right of Louis XIV. But it doesn't matter. We don't talk about politics. We talk about what it's like being president." And every president who follows makes the club a little more real. So Eisenhower gives them office space and a pension and mailing rights, and Johnson gives them Secret Service protection and the use of helicopters and even a projectionist so that when they're being treated at Walter Reed, they can check out movies from the White House film library. And, you know, Johnson adds souvenirs. You know, he gives Eisenhower a pair of cufflinks with a presidential seal, and he says, you know, you and Harry Truman are really the only guys who can legitimately wear these. And you notice it doesn't say either Democrat or Republican on them. But then it is Richard Nixon who I think really is the one who gives the club, shall we say, its most solid...
Brick and mortar?
Brick and mortar.
When we thought up the idea of doing the club, it was a shorthand expression we, Nancy and I, used to describe the project to ourselves. Let's just do the club, the guys, the fraternity. It was our conceit, construct. We didn't actually think that it was a club, much less a club with a clubhouse.
Much less a club with a secret clubhouse.
Much less a club with a secret clubhouse with a standalone bathtub. But in 1969, Richard Nixon, so tired of hearing from Lyndon Johnson, who'd retired to the Hill Country, but was calling the White House almost every day with requests for planes and cars and hotel reservations in Washington and workspace when he came to town, finally said to a young military aide of his, Nixon said, find him someplace to live, to sleep, to be when he's in town, because we can't keep doing this. The young military aide's name, by the way, was Brent Scowcroft, then a colonel in the Air Force. Scowcroft scrounges around Lafayette Square, finds a house that's kind of run down, and over the next 40 years, this would become essentially the former president's home away from home. It was a dump for a long time, just a couple of rooms and a bath. But in the last 4 or 5 years, George W. Bush significantly upgraded it. It's a really nice Four Seasons now. You can't
Which
check
only
in.
Four men can.
Right, you can't check in. Only four guys can stay there. And my favorite detail, I got in for the first time, I think I was the first reporter ever to see it about 3 weeks ago. I did a thing with CBS Morning News when the book first came out. This is a scene from the master bedroom, and I love the embossed presidential seal on the 6 gazillion thread count sheets. And I love the seal particularly because, you know, you can imagine these guys, there are only four of them. They've had a rough life. They've been out of office. You know, and they wake up. If they're not sure who they are, they can just kind of look down toward their toes and see the seal. So the clubhouse was not the last benefit of membership that has come along. George Herbert Walker Bush, when he became president, extended sort of a monthly newsletter to his fellow club members. He offered secure phone lines, which, interestingly, most of them turned down because I think they just had enough, although one President Gerald Ford did take it, and then he came to resent the fact that it was on his desk. So,
but what we found that surprised us, many things surprised us, is that often it was presidents of different parties who got along better, helped each other more than presidents from the same party. And these relationships had a way of evolving in all sorts of interesting ways over time. So here you have what is a famous picture of John F. Kennedy and Dwight Eisenhower. And the reason it's a famous picture, it's the first time that Kennedy ever went to Camp David. So Eisenhower basically was showing him around. And it is taken about 5 days after the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion, which had gone terribly wrong. And so what a young president, 4 months into his presidency, needed most was a photograph like this, where he would be seen consulting with the revered elder statesman who had not only left office an honored president, but who had been the great military hero of the 20th century. And so this was basically a trip to the woodshed in which they talked about everything that had gone wrong with the invasion and why. And at one point, Kennedy says to Eisenhower, you know, no one can really know how tough this job is until he's been in it a few months. And Eisenhower says, forgive me, Mr. President, I tried to tell you that a few months ago. And what was amazing, though, about this encounter is that, you know, for a lot of members of Eisenhower's party, they thought, thank heavens, the honeymoon is over. Now everyone realizes what they got into electing this young and experienced president. Eisenhower goes before the cameras and basically says, everyone's responsibility to support our president. He tells Republican leaders in Congress who came to see him the next weekend in a kind of pilgrimage to back off. He says, I don't want any witch hunting. He felt very strongly that especially in dangerous times, the country needed to rally around its president. The entire world was criticizing the U.S. at this point for this botched invasion. And Eisenhower was fully prepared there to defend him. Not because he agreed with what had happened or how it had been executed, just in the principle of defending the president. Even more remarkable was the night that Kennedy was assassinated. And Lyndon Johnson, now suddenly finding himself in office, calls Eisenhower and says, you know, I've needed you for a long time. I need you more than ever now. Eisenhower gets in the car the next day, drives to Washington, views Kennedy's body lying in state, but then goes to see Johnson at the White House, and they have lunch together, and Eisenhower writes out in longhand what he thinks Kennedy needs, what he thinks Johnson needs to say to a joint session of Congress at this moment of national trauma in order to signal to the country and to the world that America is going to move forward, that there will be stability and continuity. And what he basically says is, you know, to Johnson is you should vow to enact the agenda of, you know, basically your martyred predecessor. You have a Republican president advising a new Democrat to push ahead full speed with a Democratic agenda that I didn't agree with at all, but that he thought what the country and the world needed was that kind of stability. And the two men ended up, again, consulting and working very, very closely together throughout Johnson's presidency.
The alliances across party don't just take place when the presidents are in office, and sometimes the most interesting ones have taken place after they have left. This is from a chapter we call Three Men and a Funeral. When Ronald Reagan sent the three guys in this picture to the funeral of Anwar Sadat in October of 1981, the trip was significant, interesting, fascinating, astonishing for many reasons, since it all took place at 35,000 feet in a very crowded 707 that also included Al Haig, Henry Kissinger, and Michael Jackson, but that's just a whole nother movie. What happened on the plane really is what happened on the way back from Cairo when Nixon peeled off on, guess what, a secret mission to Saudi Arabia, leaving Ford and Carter, two men who didn't like each other much and who had fought like ferrets in 1976 alone on this plane, with a handful of reporters, all of whom are still alive. And Carter and Ford put aside literally 5 years of enmity and become friends. They bond over three things. The fact that they both have to build presidential libraries and have no idea what to do with them. They have to fund the libraries and have no idea how to fund them. And they both have a shared dislike of Ronald Reagan. Over the next 25 years, Ford and Carter would do about 25 projects together on balance budgets and deficits and foreign elections and nuclear weapons and everything. They would travel around the world together. It got to the point where they would be reluctant to get out of their limos together. They liked each other's company so much. They vowed within 10 years to give the eulogy of the other depending on who died first, a job that fell to Carter in 2006. And so two men who had fought quite bitterly in 1976, and Ford, who had vowed to seek revenge on Carter in 1980 but decided not to seek another, to go after him again, dies in 2006, is buried in Grand Rapids, and Rosalind and Jimmy are in the front row. Rosalind and Jimmy are in the front row in tears. Who would have thought? Another unlikely cross-party pairing. This is the buddy movie that Hollywood ought to make. But few people realize that these two guys were actually pretty good partners. When Bill Clinton is elected and sworn in January of 1993, he is the first president since Abraham Lincoln first swearing in to have five living former presidents. The club is at it's the golden age of the president's club. They all want to help Clinton. They're all fascinated by him. But no one is more fascinated than Richard Nixon, the oldest of the bunch, who is practically standing out in front of the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue, waving his arms, saying, talk to me, talk to me, talk to me. He's writing letters privately. He's writing op-eds publicly. He's threatening me in back channels, if you don't call me, I'm going to get really tough. You know, it's just a big mess. And Nixon is, Nixon literally is bad copping, good copping the new president. And finally Clinton says, okay, I'll call him. And over the course of 1993, Nixon and Clinton become late night phone pals. They talk a lot. They talk about Russia. They talk about China. Clinton at one point calls him and just asks, how do you do this job? I mean, how do you do it? How do you organize the day? How did you organize your day? And Nixon's fascinated by the fact that by the fact that Clinton doesn't know how to do it because he remembers when he got into the office and he didn't know how to organize his day and he wanted to ask Ike about it. My favorite Clinton-Nixon story, and there are a bunch, is that about a month before Clinton, Nixon dies in April 1994, he goes to Russia on a mission partially for Clinton to find out what's going on with Yeltsin. The trip's a mess. It turns out to be a disaster. But on the way back, Nixon writes, as he always did, a trip report, seven single pages, type pages, that Clinton gets and he's amazed by. It's fabulous. It's hard-headed. It's incisive. He doesn't even show it to Gore. He shows it to Hillary and Tony Lake, and that's it. He quotes it a couple of times over the next 15 years, but has never released this letter. But we asked him about it when we saw him in October or November of last year, and he said that it's so great and so wonderful that he still gets it out and rereads it every year.
So as remarkable as all these relationships are, there really isn't anything as remarkable as the fact that we actually saw a father and son follow one another in the White House. And so this picture of the two Presidents Bush is taken on the day that President George W. Bush was inaugurated. And literally, the two men have trouble even speaking. It is such a sort of overwhelming moment. Whole doctoral dissertations and many, many books and reams of copy have been written and will be written about this most fascinating relationship. And all of them tend to focus on how the father-son relationship affected the second Bush presidency. What we think is much more revealing and telling is how the second Bush presidency affected the father-son relationship. And what we were struck by is that rather than the notion that somehow of whether or not the senior President Bush was serving as an advisor and guiding his son through whatever cutouts or back channels or directly and how much tension there was between them over what to do in Iraq and policy, one thing that the first President Bush understood is that every president has a great many advisors. You only have one dad. And that what that president most needed was what only a father could give. And so the interesting thing is the extent to which the senior President Bush acted like a dad. He worried about his son. He worried about the burden that the office and the demands that President Bush was facing, particularly after 9/11 and through the war, were placing on him because he knew himself what it does to a president to send soldiers into battle. And the son actually becomes the comforter and will call his father and say, you got to stop reading the papers. You got to stop watching TV. I'm fine. Don't worry about me. You got to tune out the criticism. And it was fascinating to us the way that relationship. I mean, politics is complicated. Family is really complicated. Speaking the only thing more complicated is the other Bush father-son relationship. You know, how interesting is it that here you have a man in Bill Clinton who never knew his father and who, in a sense, found his surrogate father in a president who he defeated. And, I mean, talk about unlikely buddy movies. These men, in working together first on tsunami relief and then after Hurricane Katrina, became so close that Bill Clinton was going on vacation with the father and doing business deals with the son and escorting Barbara at Betty Ford's funeral. And it got to the point that now the Bush clan has a nickname for him. They call Clinton their brother from another mother.
You get this one.
Well, so now that we've, you know, lest we lead you to think that all is love and friendship and warmth in the President's Club, a lot of these relationships, they start out strong, they go bad, they come back, they come together, they come apart. So here we have Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower, two of the earliest club members, who work very effectively together during Truman's presidency, building the whole post-war security structure. They have a huge fight during the 1952 campaign because Truman thinks Eisenhower should have stood up to Joe McCarthy and had failed and called him a moral coward and, you know, unfit for the office. That didn't go over so well with Eisenhower. They don't speak for 8 years. Truman does not step foot in the White House. And yet, as these feuds go, they find themselves forced together, in a sense, by circumstance. In November of 1963, when they share a limousine home from Arlington Cemetery and the burial of John F. Kennedy, and Truman turns to Eisenhower and asks, "You want to come in for a drink?" And the two men spend the night talking and drinking and reconciling. And so what we found is that these relationships can go very bad, that the rivalries are often built into them, and they play for very high stakes, and never higher than with perhaps the two fiercest feuding presidents, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, who have a battle that stretches across 5 years, three continents, two presidential elections, has both of them trying to blackmail one another about the secrets that each knew about the other one. So they do not all get along beautifully. In the case of Johnson and Nixon, when it was about war and peace and who would get credit for ending the war in Vietnam and who was trying to sabotage the other one's efforts, the stakes are exceptionally high when you are battling for history's favor.
Now, some pictures really do not need a caption. And this is one of them. This is at the funeral of Coretta Scott King in 2005, maybe 2006. This was a great moment in the club history. Bill Clinton called George Herbert Walker Bush at the memorial service one of God's frozen chosen, which I thought was a nice way to describe an Episcopalian. Carter toasted the moment by criticizing Bush's son. It was just a mess. The club was just a mess that day. And here you can see George Herbert Walker Bush essentially trying to blink torture. Will someone get me away from Carter? Carter and Bush are not great buds, which is ironic because when Bush comes into office in 1989, he reaches out to Carter and puts him to work in a way Ronald Reagan never had. He sends him to Nicaragua. He sends him to Panama. The test he puts in front of Carter is dying to achieve. He does a great job with them. After really being exiled for 8 years under Reagan, Carter is back, and he's thrilled to be back. And Bush needs a kind of moderate Democrat to help him in Central America, where Reagan had pushed the policy way too far to the right. And then Carter went off the script. In 1991, well, really late 1990, Bush is organizing this remarkable coalition of 40 or 50 nations against to liberate Kuwait from Saddam Hussein. The coalition was quite astonishing. It included many countries that were not U.S. allies on anything. And with about 2 weeks to go before the war, Carter privately, secretly circulates a letter to members of the U.N. Security Council urging them to get out of Bush's coalition. So with literally 2 weeks to go before the war, you have a former president of the United States waging a secret diplomatic campaign to undermine the sitting president's diplomacy. This is very close to treason, certainly. That's what the White House thought. They let Carter know that they knew about this, and they asked him, they told him to cease and desist. Do you think Carter did it? No. He mounted a second letter-writing campaign, this time not at the UN Security Council, but at the members of the Arab League, because I think Carter felt that he was really the only American president who understood the Middle East. The only way that was resolved is that about 4 days later, the Gulf War began, and it was over not long after. Another pairing that has not been all that successful, just the picture, the body language here, that's really one warm handshake, isn't it? That's really good. These are two men who fought bitterly in 2008. Obama called Clinton a sort of missed opportunity, a presidency that was about small ball, someone who was not sort of personally able to transform the electorate the way he could have if he had seized his opportunities carefully. Clinton called Obama a fairy tale. There were worse charges traded among their aides. Of course, that's what happens when the spouse got in the way of this otherwise happy relationship. It's been a very long road back for these two men. They have never been close. They had to have a prenup. Think about it. They did. Before Hillary takes the job as Secretary of State, Obama's guys make him sign an 8-point memorandum of agreement saying you will do this but not that. You will raise money here but not there. You will say this but not that. It's a contractual relationship that they have. And Clinton wanted to help, but Obama really didn't want his help for the first 2 years until he starts taking on water and losing elections. And in 2010, he basically asked Clinton to come in, asked for his advice, has a press conference with him, and Clinton actually takes the press conference over. I know you remember that. Astonishing performance. At one point, Obama says, "I got to go to a Christmas party," and he goes, Clinton says, "Go, I'm okay, I got this." Leading John Stewart to say, "Hey, President Obama, you know, you may want to get elected a second term before you have Yoda back in the White House." Now, recently, it's gotten a little warmer. You know, if you've seen President Obama's 17-minute re-election video, I'm guessing not many of you have because it's 17 minutes long. But it's beautiful, directed by an Oscar winner and narrated by Tom Hanks. It's actually going to be nominated for an Oscar next year. The star of this movie is not the person actually running for re-election, it's Bill Clinton. He appears four times in 17 minutes, he makes the closing arguments, and he confers upon Obama the Oval Office seal of approval on the Osama bin Laden raid when he says, you know, "If I had those choices, I hope I would make that call." And it's great. It's just amazing club theater. And so you got to watch that if you haven't seen it.
So we have the thing that we take away from all of this. We have sort of one final thought about why does any of this matter? And other than that, these men who are often doing impossible jobs provide important private consolation and sympathy to one another. This is not a job you can whine about holding. And yet, Jefferson called it a splendid misery, and Buchanan called it a crown of thorns, and it's a very hard job. And so they do comfort and console each other. But more importantly, maybe for a larger purpose, is that they all believe that for America to succeed and to be safe and to prosper, the presidency itself has to function. And so we see again and again all through history, we see them working to protect the presidency itself. So Harry Truman and Herbert Hoover collaborate on the Hoover Commission to strengthen the office itself in order to be able to meet the demands of a nuclear world. And then after the 1960 presidential election, both Hoover and Eisenhower, Republican presidents, call Richard Nixon, urging him not to challenge the results because it was important that America set an example for the world about the smooth functioning of democracy and the peaceful transition of power.
And take this meeting.
And to have this meeting to show the two men, you know, to show Richard Nixon basically acknowledging Kennedy's victory, which is where this picture comes from. It happens again when Gerald Ford decides to pardon Richard Nixon, not because he is not well aware of Nixon's high crimes or misdemeanors, but because he thinks the country cannot possibly move forward if it is going to be preoccupied by a long and bitter and divisive trial. And it happens again with Ford a generation later when another president is at risk of impeachment. And Ford, not because he has any desire to save Bill Clinton's skin, but because he thinks that another long impeachment trial would be damaging to the office of the presidency itself, and so privately tries to arrange a deal whereby the whole thing would go away as long as Clinton would admit that he had lied. And there might be a censure, something short of impeachment, that would protect the office. It doesn't matter about protecting Clinton. It was about protecting the office.
And it happens in 1992, when a meeting that hardly anybody knows even took place in L.A. Clinton's just been elected. He hasn't been sworn in yet. He decides to pay a courtesy call on Ronald Reagan, who's been out of office for 4 years. And this turns out to be a very substantive conversation. And it's about the power of the presidency also. Clinton asks Reagan, "Do you have any advice for me?" And Reagan says, "Yeah, you got to go to Camp David because it'd be just good for your head and soul to get out of that place. So go," which is advice Clinton didn't really take. But he also says, "You know, I've been watching you on the campaign, and you are the wimpiest saluter I have ever seen. So you got, if you're going to do this role, if you're going to take this job," and Reagan had an exquisite understanding of what perception is in leadership and how we view and what we see, obviously, "you're going to have to learn how to salute." So he shows him, you got to bring it up slow and smart, and you got to shake it off fast. And the two men sit there in Reagan's Century City office practicing their salutes.
And so we find that at this extraordinary moment where we now have a rather large club, and it's probably only going to get larger and more important because we're electing presidents younger, and so they are serving as ex-presidents longer, George W. Bush summons the membership to meet the new guy a few weeks before President Obama's inauguration. And he says what amounts to almost, you know, a club ritual, a club protocol, which is when he says, "We want you to succeed. And all of us who've been in this office, regardless of party, understand that the office transcends the individual. It's once again, we want for a presidency itself to be successful. And so I think that at a time when, you know, our country is having all sorts of private and public conversations about the ability of our institutions to function and our leaders to lead and serious challenges to be faced, there is something instructive about watching men who had nothing in common from different generations, different parts of the country, different parties, different ideologies, different worldviews, who were able to come together against all odds and by and large find common cause in a larger purpose. If they can do it, then who's to say anyone else can't?
And we'll stop there.
Okay. Our thanks to Michael Duffy, executive editor of Time Magazine, and Nancy Gibbs, deputy managing editor of Time. Both are co-authors of The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. I wanted to hang on a thought that you talked about a few minutes ago, and it had to do with President Carter discussing with world leaders at the Security Council of the United Nations, lobbying them, as a matter of fact, against the resolution to oust Saddam Hussein's forces from Kuwait. This was a U.S. proposed resolution. And you say in the book that some in the administration thought that that was a violation of the Logan Act. That really caught my attention. Now, the Logan Act, just briefly, forbids private citizens to conduct foreign policy without authority. Could you elaborate on that a little more?
Well, this was the club's, it wasn't its worst hour. I think Nixon and Johnson both double blackmailing each other in 1969 and 1973 over the peace talks and who bugged who the worst was probably the club's low moment. But Carter is a complicated partner for everyone who follows him. He is a serious, self-righteous, precise man who works very hard at many things and does many things well. But he's not a clubby guy. He's always been at a remove, even in that picture. He's always been something of a loner. That was one of the afflictions of his presidency. I mean, he's not, to say he's not clubbable is a huge understatement. He got rid of the alcohol in the White House. He's just not someone who works as well with others as some of the others. I think he has given the club, every club needs a black sheep, you know, something to unite everyone else. And he has given them that. On the other hand, he has achieved things for all of them as well, but he is a very difficult partner.
Nancy, do you think that maybe there was a violation of the Logan Act?
I do not have a law degree, and so I would not begin to adjudicate that.
I think what matters, Joe, is that the White House thought it was, just as the White House thought Nixon had violated the Logan Act in 1968. And what's astonishing is that, I'll go a little further here, that Carter couldn't see it. And I asked Carter about it.
Would he do it differently?
Would you do it differently? And he said no. And his answer was not very convincing.
I think of two of the incidents that maybe have been the most embarrassing for the President's Club after reading the book. One might have been Carter's action with the UN Security Council. The other was certainly, and you just talked about it, Richard Nixon's trying to scuttle the Paris peace talks. And I think it was concluded in your book that the war actually ended in 1972, I believe, in Vietnam?
73.
It could have ended, possibly, in 1968 had this not happened. And I'd like you to talk about the role of Anna Chenault in this effort.
This is the other screenplay that's just waiting to be written. Anna Chenault was the widow of the great World War II hero, Claire Chenault, and she was the head of Republican Women for Nixon. And she was also very good friends with the South Vietnamese ambassador to the U.S. And so Nixon, as a candidate in 1968, enlists Anna Chenault as his sort of back channel to the South Vietnamese government. And even as Johnson is trying to orchestrate these very delicate peace negotiations in Paris between the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese and the Viet Cong and the U.S., Nixon's people are sending the private message that don't agree to the South Vietnamese, don't go along with this, you'll get a better deal if you wait for Nixon's election. Now, the wonderful thing about this is Johnson found out about this. How did Johnson find out that Nixon's people were undermining the peace talks? He found out because he wiretapped Anna Chennault. What's truly beautiful about that is, where did she live? She lived in the Watergate. So, couldn't make this up. So, but it is only in the, there, and there are other very sensitive intelligence gathering means by which Johnson and his national security team realizes the extent to which there is this sabotage operation going on. And they have to decide whether they're going to confront Nixon about it or not. And remember, it's 1968. It's a year that we've seen the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the Chicago Convention turning into riots in the streets. You know, how much can one country take? And what would have happened had an outgoing president accused the candidate of the other party of what Johnson did privately call treason? And it would have revealed, of course, how Johnson had found out. And so in the end, Johnson decides, and Humphrey, who arguably that election had gotten very, very close, Nixon had been way ahead through the summer, by late October, it was margin of error. And in the end, the peace talks fall apart at the last minute because the South Vietnamese refused to come because, you know, they'd heard they'll get a better deal. The whole thing falls apart, blows up in Johnson's face. Nixon wins the election. And so this helps to explain why Nixon, as president, is extremely solicitous about Lyndon Johnson. He knows that Johnson knows stuff about him, hence the clubhouse, hence Nixon's personally orchestrating Johnson's 61st birthday party, complete with the lemon cake and the mariachi band and the new Redwood Grove named after Lady Bird and everything Nixon could think of to keep Johnson from going off the reservation and stay quiet about what he knew.
And wait, but pay it off in 73.
So that all works out fairly well until 1973. Nixon's just been reelected by a landslide. But Watergate is now nipping at his heels, and the Senate is starting to put together its investigating committee. And so Nixon's men call Johnson down at the ranch and say, you know, you need to call your Democratic senator friends and tell them to back off on this Watergate thing, or else we're going to leak that you bugged us in 1968, which Johnson said. And then I'll reveal what I learned when I bugged you in 1968. So you have two presidents blackmailing each other, and you think, well, how is it that that didn't all blow up? Well, the reason that didn't all blow up is because 2 days after Nixon is inaugurated for his second term, Lyndon Johnson drops dead of a heart attack. And at that moment, January 1973, there is no club. Harry Truman had died at Christmas. Johnson dies on January 22nd. Nixon is all alone.
So God bless Nixon.
He does add good drama to the story.
Phenomenal drama. Now, Johnson, as I understand it, could not use the wiretap information because it was an illegal wiretap. So he just knew from the wiretap, but he couldn't disclose that publicly.
Yeah, right.
And Nixon wanted to discredit Hubert Humphrey as well because, obviously, Nixon wanted to become president. And then, as you just said, Nixon did become the president, but he was promising that there would be a better deal. And that's what really got me by the...
Snakes in a bottle.
Yeah, absolutely. He was promising a better deal. And how many lives were lost at that point? I don't know. Well, here's a question from the audience that's a little milder. It was a time when President Eisenhower was undecided about whether he was a Republican or a Democrat. Well, he wasn't president at the time, but he was going to run as either a Democrat or a Republican. If he were running for office today, how would he be treated, say, by the Tea Party?
Well, I'm not sure that he was undecided, but he certainly wasn't saying. Yeah. As long as Ike wasn't saying, Harry Truman thought he was great. Truman thought he was so great, he told Eisenhower at one point in 48, look, if you want this job, I'll step aside. You can have it. I'll be your vice president. It became harder for Truman when he realized Ike was actually a Republican. I think all of these Republicans... I would say all of these Republicans would have trouble in the current environment, including the last one. All of them. Obviously, they would.
Here's another audience question. It's a good one, I think. The President's Club is a men's club, right? So here's someone from the audience that wants to... So far. Well, there's two questions that sort of go together. One is, when do you think the fraternity will have a female member? Well, then, of course, you can't call it a fraternity anymore. But let's talk about the first ladies. This questioner wants to know, do you know of any first ladies who have a similar affection for one another?
You know, that we were in Nancy Reagan's private office yesterday because we were at the Reagan Library, and I noticed on her credenza, which is a great word, a picture of, and I know you all have them at home, is a picture of her with all of the first ladies who were alive at that time. And it's a wonderful shot. I think the role the first ladies play in this is that they are a tempering force. And in fact, the Truman-Ike rapprochement occurs when both wives are in the room at Blair House, right? Mm-hmm. I think that there's some of that. Otherwise, we don't see a lot of evidence of much, whatever sisterhood, the word is, sisterhood, beyond a certain, shared understanding of how miserable this is and how hard it is on families.
You know, interestingly, one of the things the first ladies and the president share is that the challenge of raising, not just raising children in the White House, particularly raising daughters in the White House. You had the Johnson girls and the Nixon girls and Amy Carter and Chelsea Clinton and the Bush twins and now Sasha and Malia. So there are a lot of adolescent White House daughters. And so there was a certain amount of consultation and advice, and Hillary Clinton talked about how helpful Jackie Kennedy was to her about how do you raise children under these, the glare of these lights.
And you can imagine the role that Barbara Bush played for Laura. Vast, huge. So there are these.
No, there's the same sort of bond of sympathy, I think. But what really, it is more than sympathy that the men share who have been in the job, and what really unites them, and what really surpasses all of their differences, and the reason why I think when the first woman president joins the President's Club, there's no reason to think that gender is going to separate them any more than all their incredible differences already have. I think she will be welcomed into it. She'll probably, make it a more fun place.
How about the bathtub?
The only one president can stay there at a time regardless of gender, Joe.
Okay. Well, let me say that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guests today are Michael Duffy, executive editor of Time Magazine, and Nancy Gibbs, deputy managing editor of Time. They are discussing the complex and surprising relationships between the past 13 presidents of the United States. This is known as the President's Club. You had a picture on the computer, which I'm sure the audience saw on the TV screens a few minutes ago. And it had to do with the presidents, the living presidents standing for a picture. There was another picture that I have embedded in my mind, which was at the crypt of the Obama inauguration. And it showed the presidents waiting to be introduced as they came out for the inauguration. Mm-hmm. It appeared to me that the Clintons were snubbed by President Carter. And the media wrote a lot about that. In fact, in doing some research, I watched the YouTube of that.
The Clintons were snubbed by President Carter at Obama's administration?
At Obama's inauguration, while waiting in the crypt with all of the living presidents who are going to come out.
Well, the best crypt story ever takes place at the inauguration of Eisenhower. Truman, who by now is just can't stand Ike,
it's mutual
and
at
it's
that point.
Mutual.
It's so mutual on that morning that Eisenhower initially didn't want to go to the White House to pick up Truman. It's like he can ride in his own car.
And then an event takes place where they just are determined to misunderstand each other. You should just tell that story.
So Eisenhower, his son John at the time, was serving in Korea. And Truman, as I think a genuinely thoughtful gesture, orders him home so he can see his father be inaugurated. And Eisenhower is very angry at this. And he says, he confronts Truman before they're going on the platform and says, who is it who ordered my son home from the front? And Truman basically says...
No, he says, "Do the President of the United States
ordered
him.
Or the Commander-in-Chief.
Yeah, right. That's great.
Commander-in-Chief ordered him home. And you know, the even a gesture that was meant to be, you know, on Truman's part, to be one of understanding and generosity, of you want your son to be there when you take the oath of office, Eisenhower thought was an attempt to embarrass him somehow. And these two guys just, they could not get it right, even though, and again, I think one of the reasons it was so bad between them, and, you know, that inauguration day was, you know, there have been some frosty scenes on the platform of the inaugurations, but that was probably the frostiest. I think it was all the more tense because they had, you know, Truman had sort of hero worship Eisenhower. He had admired him so much, and they had done such important things together, and they agreed on things that a lot of people throughout the government hadn't. And so they had really been united in what they were trying to do. And to have it go so bad, and go bad in really personal, the fight they had wasn't political. They fought personally about, you know, about who was morally stronger, who was more righteous. And so, you know, that was a particularly bitter feud. And it really did, it did take quite some years and a number of funerals attending together for them to get past it.
Well, that's the other picture that I was referring to. That is not in the crypt. That was, I think, in the White House.
It's in the Oval Office.
It's in the Oval Office.
In the Oval Office. And here again, Carter is standing apart from the rest of the presidents.
I think Carter puts himself at a remove, though. I don't think they all moved away like a guy's in a huddle. It's just, it's the way, that's the way he is. And he's fine with that.
You know, what he has said, President Carter has said, that he was a better ex-president than he was a president. And I think the other club members agree with that. President Carter also says that he thinks he's a better ex-president than the other ex-presidents are. They have a little harder time with that.
One of the most harrowing moments in the life of presidents is when John F. Kennedy became president and he learned about the plan of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, rather, Bay of Pigs invasion. Now, I believe you say in the book that he was not made aware of that necessarily, that Eisenhower even said he wasn't aware of a lot of the details, that it was plotted by the Secret Service. Can you...
Well, the CIA.
The
CIA. Well, you know, when covert operations get underway, Eisenhower knew and said when he was president that they have a way of...
taking on a life of their own.
Taking on a life of its own. And and he knew that he was leaving soon. And what happened is, over the course of the late, you know, last part of 1960, it took on a life of its own. The CIA took off and started planning it. There's no indication that Eisenhower would ever have approved this mission, certainly not in the, you know, crazy way it was eventually executed. Kennedy comes into power. The planning continues. He's very much aware of the fact that he's following the greatest war hero ever. Kennedy does not put a stop to it, does not get his hands dirty with it, and it goes off, and it's a disaster and a fiasco, and it leads to the famous woodshedding moment. I think propaganda machine and history machine, and they all have their post-presidency, you know, machines, tried to pin a lot of the blame of this on Eisenhower, but I was never convinced by that. This seemed to me this was something that Kennedy refused to actually get his arms around, and the proof of that is that after it happened, he completely changed the way he did his foreign policy decision-making, which is why the Cuban Missile Crisis turned out so much better. And it's not the only president or even one of five who had a similar first-year disaster and then changed.
It's, you know, President Bush, when the first President Bush said to us, you know, you campaign for the office, you study it, you see it, you think you know what being president entails. You don't know until the day you get your first intelligence briefing. And then everything changes. And there is what anyone can know before they take office, what anyone can understand from the outside. And then there is what you could only understand when you were in the job. And so Kennedy himself, you know, who had written history, he had written about presidents, he understood about the office as an outsider, as an academic. When he's asked in 1962, having now served for 2 years, to take part in a poll of historians ranking presidents, he resists. He won't do it. He says, I don't think anyone has any business judging a president unless they know what went across his desk. On what was he basing his decisions? And, of course, a lot of presidents base a lot of decisions on a lot of information that is not known publicly at the time. You know, we see through a glass darkly. And so I think that one of the things that we kept on hearing again and again and again over all of these presidents that we were studying was when they get out of office, one of the reasons they're reluctant to criticize is because they know what they don't know. And even the first President Bush would say when he would be pressed about Iraq, he says, I'm not read in. I don't have all the information that my son has. And he is. It was not just that he was trying to avoid criticizing his son, because every other president, by and large, says some version of this. You know, I'm not getting the briefings anymore. I don't know what all of the information that they have.
Well, we're now ready to take some verbal questions, and I'd like to ask anyone who is interested to step up to the microphone. And while you are queuing up, I do want to ask a question. It seems to me that maybe the best part of this job that you and Michael have would be to actually interview the president, the living presidents. Did you get to talk to each and every one of them?
Well, not all, but we interviewed Bush 1, Clinton, Carter for this. We had interviewed President Bush on this topic while he was president, President Bush 2. I'd interviewed Clinton and Bush together at one point on this topic. So we had, I think we know where they are.
Yeah.
It's an advantage of being at Time.
Sure. That's a good name. It's a good magazine. I may say it.
It's a bit of a skeleton key.
Right. Right. Well, we have several people lined up. Yes, sir. Would you please state your name and ask your question briefly,
please? My name is Peter Gisella. On page 501 and 502, you talk about Bush, first Bush, being honored at the Kennedy Center for his national service, and former President Clinton talking about a conversation he had with him, and then Bush, too. I was wondering if you could comment on that. But also aside, since these presidents support this idea, why is it so hard to get both parties to support it?
The reference in the book is to the fact that when Bush 1 leaves office, he asks Clinton to preserve the Points of Light initiative, which was a daily recognition of someone doing a good thing, for which there was some federal money at the time. When Clinton leaves office, he asks Bush 2, invoking Bush 1, will you please preserve, I think it was AmeriCorps, and Bush 2 did. The problem is these guys are just one of three branches of government, and when it comes to money, it has to go through the Congress. And there's nothing the party that knocks out a sitting president or follows a sitting president loves to do more, whether it's Democrat or Republican, than to defund whatever it is the guy who left wanted to do.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Please state your name and ask your question.
Yes, I'm Bob Lowe. I'm curious about whether your research ever addressed the question of what it's like for these guys the day after it's all over. January the 21st, no more hail to the chief, no more Air Force One. What's that like for them, and did any of them seem to prepare for or handle that moment better than others?
That's a really interesting question, and they all talk about it one way or another. You know, some of them have this great sense of freedom, and they talk about almost like they can feel the weight of the world coming off their shoulders. But more commonly, you know, Carter talked about being depressed for about a year. A lot, obviously, has to do with the circumstances under which you leave office. If you left before you had planned to, it's a much more difficult transition to make. These also tend to be, you know, the big personalities, big egos, big ambitions, and it is very hard, you know, in the most obvious human terms, to go from being the leader of the free world to taking out the trash yourself. But I do think it's harder for some than for others. And what's interesting now is that because they are often being elected younger, leaving office sooner, and living longer, they now are aware that they are going to have to invent a whole new life for themselves. That in September, Jimmy Carter will surpass Herbert Hoover as the longest living ex-president. It'll be 31 years, 8 months, 23 days.
Yeah.
It's a whole second career, a second, third, and fourth career, you could argue. And so they're more aware of that now. And I think while they are still in office, they are thinking about what the next chapter is going to be. Yeah. Is there going to be a way that they can continue to serve or continue to be involved and to write their next chapter?
Michael, any comment on that? Okay, thank you, sir. Your name, please.
I'm Peter Amico. It seems like if I were to abstract this conversation to a higher level, Everybody pretty much hates Carter, kind of not a surprise. But everybody really likes Clinton, except for Carter, of course. So what is it about Clinton that really, what is really about Clinton that really, does he get along with everybody? What are his personality types that make him kind of an active, likable member of this fraternity? Because he seems to be the...
Did you miss the 90s?
Well, he was my favorite president. But what is it in this club?
Well, let me say, before you should talk about Clinton, but I would say, if I had to say about who's sort of the most popular member of the club, or who, in a way, is sort of the president of the President's Club at the moment, it's the first President Bush. He's the one that they sort of turn to and
he's
defer to.
He's the oldest.
He's the oldest. They all really honor him, and in the case of at least two, if not three of them, he is sort of a father figure. So I think, you know, he's probably, he would, you know,
Clinton is still a huge handful. I was once interviewing Clinton and Bush about this, and Clinton, you know, there was some reluctance, I think, on the Bush team to actually do the joint interview because I think they were worried that Clinton would do all the talking. That's not love. That's like, who's going to do all the talking? And I remember Bush grabbed me after one part of the interview, and Clinton had gone off, and he said, "I'm out of this. He's still in it," and that's still true. So that it's not unadorned. It's not even. And Obama certainly. I don't think we're at love yet. So I don't think it's unalloyed. That's a little too reductive. I think they all see that Carter has extraordinary capabilities and can unlock doors and go places they can't go. They all have used him. Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama. They have all used Carter. They've all sent him places. They have all been successful in several times. So it's not that simple.
Yes, sir.
My name is Hansel Tomening. I understand that W didn't have any sons, but is there any truth that Jeb has a son named George, enter initial here, Bush?
George P. George
Prescott. Yeah, that they're grooming.
Bush. And what's the second
part?
And
that they're grooming for this club?
Well, if your name is Bush and you're... It's the family business. I mean, grooming sounds like a master plan, you know, cooked up in a stone building with no windows. It's the family business. And the reason the Bushes have gotten, you know, a son and a father elected in the space of 8 years is because they're good at it. They work it hard. They go where the people are. They study the country. They don't just stay like the Adams did in Massachusetts. You know, Prescott was from Connecticut. George was from Texas. Jeb moved to Florida. These people move with the country. They keep their ear to the ground. I have nothing but good things to say about the Bush's ability to do American politics. Their results are manifest when it comes to getting elected. So, grooming? No more than, you know, a zillion... Hello, what state am I in? I can't remember the name of the governor. You know... And what was the sister, Kathleen... trying to remember. She's a good friend, you know. But, I mean, grooming, this is, in America, politics is a family business. It's always been a family business. And the clans tend to be good at it. And they're good at it because they have good role models. And if you don't like it, you should vote for someone else.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there is time for just one last question. So today was a bombshell. But let me tell you what happened last Sunday. Is the vice president was on national TV and he talked about gay marriage, sort of broke the ice. One of your colleagues, Mark Halperin, has been in the news today and previously and a few days past. This headline says, Mark Halperin predicts Obama will endorse gay marriage and help him win re-election. And guess what? Today at 5:22 p.m., as I was leaving my office, I got an email. Not that I'm special, but from the President of the United States. I'm on his mailing list. He says, today I was asked a direct question, and I gave a direct answer. I believe that same-sex couples should be allowed to marry. I hope you'll take a moment to watch the conversation on the YouTube that accompanies the email. Could I have your comments on this?
I have not read the President's statement. I have been on a book tour for 3 days. I am perhaps the least informed person in the room about this. But I'll tell you what I... therefore, it qualifies me to comment on it. I know very little, but here's what I think. The Democratic Party has not... is in motion on this. I think the president has been about where the party as a whole nationally has been. It has been in motion for a couple of years, and I think this is a reflection by the White House that it had fallen behind. I think it's a fraught problem for him because I think it activates both the Republican base, but it also activates some of the Democratic base as well. Do I think it's going to change much? My gut instinct is no, but I also think this is an issue that has not played well for Democrats at the national level yet. It has played well for them sometimes in key states. California is not one of those key states. Mm-hmm. So I think it kind of matters whether it will have an impact in states like Virginia, Ohio, where I'm from. And I don't see that as a positive in my home state for Obama. I think it will matter to some extent in Pennsylvania. It could matter in Florida, but I don't see it. I think as a matter of politics, that's what it is. As a matter of policy, I think the president has decided to take a leadership position on a civil rights issue that will, in 20 or 25 years or maybe less, not be a big deal.
Okay. Nancy, would you care to make a comment on that? Okay, well, this has been terrific. Our thanks to Michael Duffy, executive editor of Time Magazine, and Nancy Gibbs, deputy managing editor of Time. Both are co-authors of The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and internet. We also want to remind everyone here that copies of the book, The President's Club, are on sale in the lobby. Mr. Duffy and Ms. Gibbs will be pleased to sign them immediately following the program. We therefore appreciate your allowing them to make their way to the lobby as quickly as possible. My name is Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.